We live so much of our lives digitally, from text messages to online videos. Wired magazine wondered if it's possible for somebody to just disappear. So they sent writer Evan Ratliff out to start a new life incognito. They offered $5,000 to the person who could find him within 30 days and tell him the password. Fluke. Alex Cohen of member station KPCC reports.
Evan Ratliff wasn't allowed to hide out in a tent for a month. He had to go places, be public, both in the real world and online. So he picked a fake name, James Donald Gatz, a nod to a character in The Great Gatsby, to confuse people who Googled him.
The idea was they would go Google that and say, ha ha, you have the same name as the guy in The Great Gatsby, and I would say yes.
As Don Gatz, he traveled unnoticed from San Francisco to Las Vegas to Venice Beach. He also set up a fake Facebook profile and Twitter account.
I was, you know, describing where I was and what I ate and that kind of thing. When the contest was over, I could say, hey, look, everybody, I've been broadcasting exactly where I was this entire time.
And people all over the world were looking for him. Take Sarah Minello of Rochester, New York.
Well, I would start, I would wake up, I would check online to see if anything happened while I was sleeping. And then I would make phone calls pretty much from then until around 4 o'clock in the morning.
Sarah made over 1,000 calls looking for Evan. One guy in Seattle set up a Facebook application. A 16-year-old kid in Oregon created a secret chat room to share information. Some clues were provided by Wired. Evan likes soccer, dive bars, and he can't eat gluten because of a medical condition. Meanwhile, this band, the Hermit Thrushes, had hooked up with Evan through a ride-sharing site. Drummer Sam Tremble.
The only rules we have on the bus are no whiners, no minors, and no drugs. And he seemed to fit the bill.
Don Gatz traveled with the band all the way to St. Louis. From there, he went on to rent an apartment in New Orleans, catch a soccer game in Salt Lake City. He narrowly dodged getting caught at the Atlanta airport. With each step, Evan grew more paranoid. Whenever people looked at him, he worried they'd say, fluke.
I became more and more emotionally attached to the idea that I was going to show all of these thousands of people that, you know, they had found all this information on me, but they weren't going to catch me.
For a long time, it seemed like the contest was unwinnable.
Jeff Reifman, who had set up the Facebook application, was stumped until he saw an online video interview Evan did in California.
The question is, are you at all concerned about swine flu, the H1N1 virus?
No, it just doesn't seem like it's that much worse than the regular flu.
Reifman thought that shaggy-haired guy with the goatee and glasses looked familiar.
I recognized that disguise as an account in our Facebook Vanish Team application. Someone named James Donald Gatz.
He followed that account to a Twitter account, which was following a New Orleans business that sold gluten-free pizza.
Naked pizza.
When I first got the email from Jeff, it read like one of these desperate letters from a princess in Nigeria needing nothing more than my account number to wire me some money.
Once Jeff Leach, owner of Naked Pizza, figured out the contest was legit, he took the hunt off the internet and onto the New Orleans streets. Leach passed out photos of Evan to his staff, flagged every gluten-free order, but no Evan. There was, however, one more clue, leaked by Wired, that Evan was probably headed to a book reading. Jeff Leach went to a local bookstore that night with a friend.
And a guy went by on a bicycle.
I thought, well, I'll be cautious with these guys, and I'll act like I'm walking by the place.
And he made eye contact with me.
And one of them took a step towards me and said,
do you know anybody named Flute?
I was frozen for a second, and then I just said, yeah, that's me.
Evan Ratliff lost the contest, but he gained a very real glimpse of what it means to vanish.
There was a feeling of freedom in it, and there were moments in there where it felt like I didn't have any obligations. I was just sort of out there on my own having new adventures.
But having those adventures without being able to share them with his real life, family, and friends, Evan says that wasn't worth much at all. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with us as usual. Hi, Lee. What's up?
Hey, Michelle. This week we received some critical feedback for our parenting segment on how working mothers are sometimes frowned upon in custody battles. Here's a clip from that conversation with family attorney Shantice Curry Try.
We've abolished the 10 years doctrine, which basically says that there is a motherly preference in the courts. When a mother decides to step outside her box, which is the cooking and cleaning and taking care of the kids, and actually decide to do something outside of the home, she is held to a higher standard of scrutiny when it comes to custody cases.
And Michelle, many listeners wished our conversation had included a male perspective, but that wasn't the only criticism. Here's a note from John. He writes, I think it's obnoxious that your host and guests have the audacity to presume that now that men and women are getting equal treatment in custody assessments, it's somehow a punishment of moms working and not playing the traditional mom role. I am a working father, I am married to a working mother, and we work very well together. But if that were to go south, I'm comforted by the fact that I will be given the same custody consideration as my children's mother.
John, we thank you for writing, but I'm going to push back on this. I'm going to point out that this conversation was not based on a presumption. It was based on reporting and the experiences of those offering their views, and there is a difference. You can agree with it or disagree with it, but that's what it was, and I invite listeners to listen again to the conversation if they want to understand this issue further from the perspective of those who were discussing it. And now on to another important topic. We received some very personal stories in response to the controversial new guidelines issued by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. That's an independent panel of experts appointed by the Department of Health and Human Services, and the task force said that women can now wait an additional 10 years before getting an annual mammogram. They should start at age 50, the panel said, instead of age 40, and that most women ages 50 to 74 can even skip a year between exams. Here's Dawn. This is what she had to say.
At age 40, I had my first mammogram and then an ultrasound, which revealed invasive cancer. I had no symptoms and no risk factors for breast cancer. I don't care what the statistics show. You cannot put a value of my life into a statistic.
Well, Dawn, we thank you very much for sharing your story with us and our very best wishes to you.
Well, Michelle, we heard from another online commenter, Trina, who takes another perspective. She agrees with the agency guidelines.
I'm happy that I no longer have to endure the stress of being pinched, prodded, and stuck unnecessarily because of a false positive exam. I think that the reasoning behind the new recommendation is because of people with what we call my family lumpy breast, where we end up going through weeks of agony thinking that you might have breast cancer when in fact you just had lumpy breast.
And Michelle, another commenter, is just unsure about the whole thing. Here's Lynn expressing her concerns.
I believe in math and statistics, and I still haven't made up my mind. I'm not technically in a high-risk group, no family history, but I am overweight, and I know that increases my risk. I think I should continue to have my annual exam, but what will my insurance company say? That concerns me.
Well, according to Kathleen Sebelius, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Lynn, she says, don't stop doing what you're doing. The Cabinet Secretary issued a statement earlier this week saying, quote, mammograms have always been an important life-saving tool in the fight against breast cancer, and they still are today. Keep doing what you have been doing for years and make the decision that is right for you. And on Monday, we're going to continue talking about this issue, so I want to thank all of our listeners for weighing in and sharing their stories and concerns and questions. And thank you, Lee, for updates.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our new website, where you can read more from fellow listeners and enjoy a simpler social networking experience. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Next up, personal solar power station, but I'm not talking about in the traditional way with a big bank of batteries or a connection to the power company for a rainy day or anything like that. What if you had a solar panel on your roof that could easily make hydrogen from the sun? Use the sun's rays to make hydrogen, and you power up your own personal fuel cell. You store that solar energy in the form of hydrogen over time, and you just click a switch and use it when it's needed. Well, with the right chemistry and the right catalyst, it might be possible. Joining me now is Daniel G. Nocera. He is the Dreyfus Professor of Energy and Chemistry, and he's also Professor of Chemistry at MIT in Cambridge. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Now, you guys have developed a new catalyst that can take the hydrogen out of the water more efficiently?
Yep, that's what it does. It actually splits water, and so when you take water and you split it, you get hydrogen and oxygen. And you might remember even seeing that in grade school or sure. high school, where a teacher put two electrodes in a beaker, and you saw the hydrogen and oxygen bubbling out. So we did the same thing. But we aren't using platinum. We're using a really inexpensive catalyst. that operates under a whole bunch of variety of conditions that no existing catalyst could operate by previously.
Mm-hmm. So you could take a solar panel. Are you saying that you can hook it up to photovoltaic roof panels, or are you going to have it work like using something else?
There's a bunch of ways we found this catalyst works, and one way is exactly what you just said. Just take the solar panel, put it up on your roof,
right,
and then solar panels put out electricity, which you could use when the sun's shining. And if you wanted to, you could take some of that electricity, feed it to this catalyst, which then when it gets electrified from the photovoltaic, it splits water to hydrogen and oxygen. Another way you could do it is this catalyst forms directly on the PV material, which is a semiconductor. And so then you can just shine light right on the semiconductor, never really get the light to electricity directly, just use the energy of the supercharged photovoltaic to split water to hydrogen and oxygen, because the catalyst is coated on the semiconductor, so it can basically take the energy from the photovoltaic directly.
Wow. And so how close are you to making these kinds of devices?
We're really close. As a matter of fact, for the first one where you would feed it electricity from a photovoltaic, we actually have built this out of polyvinyl chloride, PVC piping.
That white piping you get at the store.
Mm-hmm.
That white piping we see.
That white piping, yep.
That plastic stuff
that's in your basement maybe that's carrying all the water around your house.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really cheap, and the catalyst is very inexpensive. Because we're in water, we've been able to invent another catalyst that makes the hydrogen. So this is important. Usually when you split water, the first thing you make is oxygen, and then you leave protons behind, which later are combined to make the hydrogen. And the catalyst we invented splits the water, does the hard, heavy lifting to make the oxygen. The hydrogen then is made now not – also usually people use platinum. We've been able to use an inexpensive alloy of metals. And then we have a plastic membrane. So for a 100-watt system, we're building these things for almost under $30 right now.
Wait a minute. You can build a $30 photovoltaic system? It makes 100 watts?
Yeah, not the photovoltaic. I still need to pay for the photovoltaic,
right,
but in terms of feeding the electricity from the photovoltaic into this little system, we can build that very cheaply. And so I'm hoping, we were fortunate enough to get what's called an ARPA-E. I just heard Norm Augenstein mentioned in the last segment. Norm was one of the people who championed for the Department of Energy to get a program to take science innovation to a technology. Mm-hmm. And we were lucky, we were able to get one of those, and we're planning with under a year and a half to have prototypes built and working.
Is it possible to mimic photosynthesis at all and make them split the water instead of making wood out of it?
Yep. You basically nailed the essence of the discovery, because what happens in a plant when sunlight hits the leaves, an elaborate reaction starts, but what it's really doing is taking the sunlight, and you have to, of course, give the plant water, and what it's doing is it's splitting water to oxygen and hydrogen. It's stored as solid hydrogen, though. It's called NADPH, but that's exactly what the plant is doing. Then what it does is it needs to then take the hydrogen, and it needs a carrier. It just stores the hydrogen, and it stores it with CO2. And that's where it makes wood, and that's what the plant needs to do to stand up. But if it were just an energy machine, you wouldn't have it do that. You would just take the water splitting reaction up front to store the energy in, and that's exactly what we've done.
Wow, so it's like an artificial photosynthesis.
Catalyst is even great because it even has the same type of structure as what's in a plant. So it really looks a lot like what's happening inside a plant.
That's interesting. So I guess in your home, then, you would have a tank to store the hydrogen and some place to go into a fuel cell.
That's right. So at the end of the day, after this catalyst does its job and makes the hydrogen and oxygen, put a tank and just bury it outside. You don't have the problems you do in transportation because, of course, if you're moving a car, you want those tanks to be pretty tiny. You can live with a you know, a pretty big tank. You just put it underground. And then at night, you, like you said, you flip the switch and just let the hydrogen go in the fuel cell and you power your house.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this a catalyst something you've patented over there and you license it, or how would it get into the mainstream?
Yeah, that's moving very quickly. As a matter of fact, I just left the meeting with a very, very large photovoltaic company who we're now working and negotiating with them to actually make an integrated device.
Is it American or foreign?
And it's half and half. It's American and it's foreign. I will say the foreign countries tend to be a little bit further ahead of us in solar energy, so they've been the first to jump on it. But American companies, at the end of the day, you're going to need a lot of pieces. I have a catalyst. I can split water cheaply. Mm-hmm. I can even use the Charles River and dirty water. But if you start thinking about all the components we're talking about, it's going to involve lots of partnerships, and there's a lot of American and foreign companies involved. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, this thing is moving pretty quickly. There's IP, MIT owns it, and they've licensed it. And the licensee is helping me make this a technology.
So give us a ballpark on when we might see it on someone's roof. Is it, you got a roof in MIT where it's working?
Actually, what I was just talking to with this PV company is of building a house, and they're in terms of making an integrated module, and we would like to do that fairly soon. But I'm going to give you a number. It's 8.1254 years. And
I thought it was 2.553 in my calculations.
The reason why I said that was I was on CNN, and the first column was, how come scientists always say 10 years? And if you say 8.1254, people think, wow, that guy's really thought this out carefully.
Well, I was off just by a little on my calculations. 1-800-99-8255. Let's see if someone's got a question. Yeah, we do. Anne in Barrington. Is it Barrington, Rhode Island?
Yep.
Hi there.
It is. Hi. Are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
I was wondering if the hydrogen ion is really acidic, right? So will it start to eat through the materials it's stored in?
Yep. So, Anne, that's a absolutely beautiful and wonderful question.
Oh, thank you.
When you take water and you split it, you actually make protons and it becomes acidic. And that's why people hadn't been able to do this before. You should know that people have been you can buy commercial electrolyzers, mm-hmm. and they work really well, but they're super expensive. And an electrolyzer splits water. And they're expensive because you start making the acid. So you have to run the electrolyzer in very concentrated base, like lye.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps the acidity down, but then it brings a whole bunch of extra cost to the system, and it makes it expensive. And our catalyst, the one special thing we did is that when you do build up the acid, it actually can start eating the catalyst a little bit. But as it does, we put in, and this is the first time a scientist has ever been able to do this, is my students were able to figure out how to make it self-heal itself.
Huh.
So after the protons and the acid starts getting to the catalyst actually rejuvenates and fixes itself. And that was one of the big key discoveries to make this catalyst work.
Wow. That's amazing. Oh, well, thank you very much.
It's good, it's good, Anne, that he gave his students some credit, didn't he?
Yes, it is. And it's really interesting because I think when I took chemistry years ago, I was trying to figure out something like that, but that's about as far as my chemistry goes, being able to know a tiny bit about the water molecule. But this is really fascinating, and I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
People are thinking about this.
Oh, yeah. Right. You want to know why? It's because this is the world, and there's no question. The world of the future is you will generate your own energy and be in control of your own energy. And that really captures your imagination because that's how you like to live. Most people like to live in control of their world. The energy thing's scary because we're always getting energy from someplace over there and things aren't mm-hmm. too happy or stable. Mm-hmm. So it really makes, at least I've noticed, because a lot of the public will contact me by email, the one theme I see from them is they find comfort in thinking that someday they'll just use the sun that's just shining on their face, to be able to generate their own energy and live basically an autonomous world.
So your solar power device might come online just about the same time a plug-in electric car Yep. You got enough power to plug it in, charge it up at night from that?
You could do that. So you could use the electricity from the fuel cell and charge the battery. The other interesting thing, this is a little further off, but, you know, I'm an academic, so we can always, we aren't so tied by a product next year, even though now I am, as I try to develop a technology. But one of the things that keeps fuel cell cars are really wonderful machines. If you see the Mercedes F-Series, Toyota, Honda, they use hydrogen, and then there's a fuel cell in the car. They're much, much better than the battery cars. The all-battery cars are very heavy with lots and lots of batteries.
So I see where you're heading with this. Just hit this hydrogen right into your car.
No, that's what's hurt the fuel cell industry is you have to distribute hydrogen, and it's hard to think about how will you have hydrogen gas stations. All of a sudden, your house just became a gas station, too.
Wow. Quite fascinating. I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us. And what'd you say, 8.2134?
8.1254 years.
Okay.
8.1254. Okay. I'll be there.
All right. We'll be there with you. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Be with us. Dan Nocera is the Henry Dreyfuss Professor of Energy and Professor of Chemistry at MIT in Cambridge. They know how to get things done over there.
Now to today's big TV news. Oprah Winfrey told her audience that her show will come to a close at the end of next season.
The countdown to the end of the Oprah Winfrey Show starts now. And until that day in 2011, when it ends, I intend to soak up every meaningful, joyful moment with you.
And for more than 23 years, Oprah Winfrey has soaked up a lot of moments. She shared the details of her own life with her millions of viewers, and she convinced a lot of celebrities to share intimate details of their lives, too. She made everyday people, mostly women, feel as though she was their best girlfriend. And, of course, she created a media juggernaut beyond the TV show. Well, Oprah Winfrey's sights are now set on cable and her new outlet called OWN for the Oprah Winfrey Network. And joining us now is Maureen Ryan, TV critic for the Chicago Tribune, which is a hometown paper for Oprah, at least for now, given the rumors that she might move to L.A. Maureen Ryan, first of all, Oprah's got about 2 years to say goodbye, but she still apparently had to hold back tears today. What did you think of the announcement?
I wasn't actually shocked by it. I was a little surprised, but because she's such an institution, she's someone who's been on the TV every day for so long that it's very hard to picture the world without her. She really made it all about the connection with the viewers and the connection she's had with them, and she didn't really talk in detail about what she's doing next and what her new ventures will be.
She is a colossal figure in culture, in determining what books will become bestsellers. She's been in the movies and in business. But is there any one single thing that you would say about the impact that she's had?
You know, think about the things that people talk about on TV now that we take as commonplace, that we don't even raise our eyebrows at. The stuff that's in the tabloids, you know, there's always been scandal sheets and so forth. But now it's an acceptable thing for people to talk about really intimate details of their lives, really intimate details of their personal stories. And we don't flinch at it. You know, there were things that she brought up or made famous on her show that we certainly as a culture were not comfortable with chatting about over coffee 20 years ago, 24 years ago. So I think it's really been a shift that she's been a big part of.
She's been able to look at people and say, talk to me, just you, me, and the 7 million people who are watching right now.
And that's an incredible skill. I think that's really, people say, gosh, she's paid so much and she's so, why does she get this kind of accolade or this level of fame? And I think it's because to be able to look at another person and create that moment of intimacy in the interview, but then also to be able to look at the viewer, look in the camera, and make that viewer feel like she's connected to you. She has that incredible skill to make it look easy, and it's not easy.
In this move of Oprah to a cable channel, we don't know exactly what she's going to be doing there, but who were the likely winners and losers from that shift?
I think cable's the big winner. You know, I think the losers are actually quite legion. You know, there are certainly viewers who will miss her daily presence. But I think a lot of what she's become, what the show has become, and not in my view necessarily for the good, it's become a juggernaut for popular culture or the promotion of certain consumer items or films or movies or entertainment. There's a certain element of her show now that I think has gotten more pronounced, that she is really a part of the industrial entertainment, you know, juggernaut, and she's there for the publishers and the film promoters and people in the entertainment industry who are promoting a new album or a product of some kind. And those people will certainly very much miss Oprah, and also the celebrities who have some mistake they want to correct or some public perception they want to change, and they will not have that couch anymore to jump on or cry on as they will.
Just one last point. In recent years, I gather her ratings have declined on television. Do you see that just as a statement of where television is in general and she's leaving at the top of her game, or has Oprah Winfrey possibly, to use the technical term of TV analysis, jumped the shark? That is she past her prime?
I would tend to think that it's more the first thing you said about ratings just declining in general. I think that that's just an erosion that is across the board and kind of unstoppable, it seems, at this point. But I think it's also a case of, you know, maybe there is a little bit of Oprah fatigue. I mean, certainly in the last couple of years, especially with her coming out in support of Barack Obama, that sort of changed the perception of her. And I think, you know, the perception of Oprah as being apolitical and in love with books and movies and movie stars and personal stories sort of altered a little bit. So I think there was a natural kind of alteration of her image. And I think that probably led to a decline in some ratings. And again, I think, you know, she sees that coming and she sees it as the right time to make a change. And, you know, she's nothing if not perceptive about the media industry, as we've learned over the last 24 years.
Maureen Ryan, TV critic for the Chicago Tribune, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Millions of Americans will be taken to the highways this Thanksgiving week. For most, the journey will end safely, but for some, it will be deadly. Last year, nearly 400 people were killed in traffic accidents over the Thanksgiving holiday. That's a tiny fraction of the 37,000 people killed in crashes last year. Still, road deaths have declined sharply, and last year, the U.S. recorded the fewest highway deaths since 1961. This week, NPR is looking at different aspects of road safety. Our series begins with a look at the testing and technologies that are making vehicles safer. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety's Vehicle Research Center sits in the hills near Charlottesville, Virginia. In the lobby, two smashed Chryslers greet guests. Further inside are dozens of other wrecks, some more disturbing than others. The Institute's Russ Rader is our guide.
When we did this test with a crash test dummy sitting in the driver's seat with grease paint on the side of her head, you can see where her head was struck by the hood of the SUV. And that would have been a fatal crash in a real-world scenario.
Today we're going to witness another side impact crash test of a new Ford Ranger pickup. David Zuby is a vice president of the Institute.
We're going to run into it with what we call a moving deformable barrier. It's going to come from that door behind you, running down the runway at 31 miles an hour.
The Insurance Institute spends about $1.5 million a year buying new cars from area dealers and then crashing them, usually twice a week. The result, says Zuby, a safer, more crash-worthy car.
We were talking about the frontal crash test in 1995. Half the vehicles that we tested only earned a poor rating from us. Today, virtually every car we run in that configuration earns a good rating.
The Insurance Institute has just released its latest list of top safety picks. It's a smaller list than last year because of a new test to determine a car's ability to withstand a rollover. Meanwhile, technician Tyler Ayers painstakingly applies grease paint to the face of a small female crash test dummy sitting in the Ford's cab.
We got to be as light as we can because, especially with this dummy, it doesn't weigh very much. Literally just pushing on it with your finger, enough pressure to, I say, turn the back of your fingernail white, could move it a degree. And so you have to gingerly, you have to apply it, but very, very light.
After the crash, technicians will note where the grease paint leaves its mark, hopefully on the vehicle's airbags. The crash test dummies are integral to the work of the Insurance Institute. They have their own lab where they sit in varying sizes and functions, awaiting their call to duty. Spare heads are lined up on a shelf. Institute Vice President Joe Nolan says the dummies don't say much, but convey a lot of information.
This guy can measure the deflection in the chest. It's got sensors in the top, so you can measure forces wanting to rip the head off to the rear, to the left, and up. So bending this way, and bending that way.
And he says they always come back for more.
They can take a huge beating. In fact, all of their parts are replaceable. And so you never have a spare crash test dummy to throw away, despite the hundreds of requests we get at Halloween for spare dummies that people want to put on the front porch.
Hey, Bob, can I get a status check on the vehicle, please?
Sir, vehicle power on, main battery voltage 12.9.
Back in the crash test hall, preparations are just about complete for today's main event. The movable barrier, kind of a battering ram on wheels, sits down a 600-foot-long hallway behind a pair of garage doors, as if there are worries it might escape.
Charging is now complete. Test will commence in 4 seconds. 3, 2, 1, we're underway.
The pickup and its dummy occupant sit all innocent and unaware as the barrier zips down the hall, a guided drone intent on destruction. And just like that, it's over. Technicians with brooms sweep up the broken glass and check for fuel leaks. The side of the Ranger is pretty well stoved in, notes Joe Nolan.
Well, it looks like a lot of deformation, and that makes it a real challenge for the airbag to protect the occupant.
But according to the readout from the dummy's sensors, if there had been a person in the cab, she'd probably be okay. As cars have gotten more crashworthy, automakers are turning to technology to help drivers avoid crashes, electronics that prevent skidding and rollovers, and cameras and radar that see objects drivers might hit. David Zuby.
Other cars, trees at the side of the road, what have you, and make calculations about how quickly am I approaching this, and do we have time to apply the brakes and avoid the impact altogether.
Even with such high-tech safety systems, it's unlikely car crashes will ever be eliminated. But Zuby says with that as a goal, there's a chance of coming close. Brian Naylor, NPR News.
Tomorrow, a look at how road design is changing to improve safety. Watch crash test videos and crash test dummies through the ages at NPR.org.
Last month marked the 40th anniversary of what we now call the Internet. We continue our series, The Net at 40, this week with a look at an Internet relic, bulletin board systems, or BBSs. Born in Chicago in 1978, they would grow to number over 100,000 by the mid-1990s, only to be rendered obsolete by the World Wide Web. Just a few struggle on today. Producer Phil Harrell has this look back.
These were the original online social networks. Before Craig had his list, before friend was a verb, there were BBSs.
In this age of information, it is hard to ignore the fact that the number of personal computers is on the rise.
This 1992 instructional video said it all.
But most people are not aware of the possibility to connect their home computer to another in the outside world to share a vast resource of information and data.
The model for a bulletin board system is just like it sounds.
Tom Jennings was an early adopter of the bulletin board in the late 1970s.
It's the cork board in the entranceway to a supermarket. You know, you got a barbecue for sale, you put a 3x5 card with the description and your phone number, and you thumbtack it to the wall, and there's a whole collection of these things. It's a sort of a form of social commerce.
Tom Jennings went on to create something called FidoNet, which would revolutionize the way BBSs talk to each other. Sort of the first strands of the World Wide Web. Here's how it worked. Each individual BBS had its own phone number, usually run out of somebody's house. So a PC owner interested in connecting with that person's BBS would pick up the phone and dial in, and they'd be met with a rather rude answer. Then you'd quickly unplug the cord from the phone and jam it into the modem, and you're off. Before the BBS, the Internet was the exclusive domain of big business and big universities. All of a sudden, it was ours.
It was hobbyist-based. It was much more egalitarian. Any fool with $1,000 to put a machine together could be on the net. You did not have to go through layers of academic or corporate access. So bulletin boards were wild and woolly.
Tom Jennings saw the BBS expand from geeky computer talk, his words, not mine, to covering all sorts of different topics. Sports, fantasy gaming.
Sex and relationships, clearly has driven network communication since the start.
Hobbies, philosophies.
Just general birds of a feather kind of stuff, people who have similar interests.
BBS has opened up the world of computing to a generation that would go on to completely integrate computers into their lives. But by the mid-1990s, BBSs were obsolete, and their numbers took a nosedive. But believe it or not, there are still plenty around, even today. Most of them operate like any old website, but a handful of dial-ups are still out there. You can still dial in to a BBS, provided you've still got a modem.
My name is Michael Powell, and I run the Capital City Online BBS.
And he's been running it in one form or another since 1989.
It seems sort of a shame just to stop.
Michael Powell lives in Kentucky, where he says he spends about $13 a month to keep the phone line running and that extra computer powered up at all times.
As far as the actual dial-up goes, I might get two or three people a week, where it used to be you'd probably get that many in a 2 or 3 hours.
His BBS currently has conversations going on about the healthcare debate and politics and the sort of computer questions he always got back in the day. Most of his fan base went away with the advent of the World Wide Web.
Now, there is one person I still sometimes see his name out there. He's still posting. He was a user of mine back in the early 90s.
But these days, Michael Powell says, most of the people who come to Capital City Online do it just for the nostalgia value.
When I get a new caller that calls in dial-up, usually they'll compliment me on keeping it going and, still having it up the old-fashioned way. It's nice to know that they appreciate that, and it's nice that I'm still here to provide, that for them.
Powell says he has no plans to shut down his BBS, obsolete or not.
I've always said that if that particular computer I have it on, if it crashes, I might be hard-pressed to justify the cost of setting it up again. But so far, so good on that.
There's a website called BBS Corner that maintains a list of the remaining dial-ups in North America, 41 by their count, including Michael Powell and his Capital City Online, still making beautiful music together after 20 years. Phil Harrell, NPR News.
You can find that list of the remaining dial-up BBSs and other stories in our Net at 40 series at our website, npr.org.